Ladies and gents, welcome to another episode of Masters of Marketing. In this episode, I have a special guest, Dave Crane. I've been wanting to meet him for years, and finally I did. Great guy. We talked a lot about public speaking. We talked about life and how to be yourself, where to start with personal branding, what are the tricks and tips to make it a better leader, a better person. Listen up. I think it's a great session. I didn't cover half the questions that I had for him. And we agreed that we'll do another session. So check it out. Let me know what you think in the comments. And if you want to reach out to Dave, where can they reach you on?
Go to speakonstage.com.
Speakonstage.com. And I'm going to anyway tag him in all the posts. Cheers. Dave Crane, welcome to Masters of Marketing.
Thank you, Basim. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man. Who is Dave and what do you do for a living?
Good question. I feel like I'm in a job interview already.
Tell me about you, Dave.
Okay, so I've been around for a very long time, hence the grey hair and beard and so on. The background's very simple. I grew up in the UK, north of England. Actually, grew up in Scotland and went to school there until about the age of 12. My parents decided that maybe I wasn't doing as well at school as I could do, and we changed my dad's job because it was very challenging in Scotland in the late 70s, early 80s to not only be a black kid, but also be a black English kid. So the odds were stacked against me. So we moved down to England, and everything changed dramatically for me there. We moved to the northeast of England, and within a very short amount of time, because the Scottish education system is very, very good, I had massive advantages of going to the same year, but from the point of view of the level I'd got to in Scottish education. So I found that when I arrived, it was much easier to get on with everybody and be positioned as somebody who knows what they're doing, because I was slightly older because of the age gap with the intake in Scotland versus England, but also the fact I'd covered a lot of the work that they were doing. So when anybody goes to school, especially going to a new school, it's really important to be able to establish yourself. Because that the playground is as much of a, in fact, it's probably more of a battleground for creating relationships with people than the stuff you do in your school. Sports is important, but you've got to fit in. And I found that it was really easy to connect with people and get on with people from the advantages I'd learned from being in Scotland beforehand. So I went through that. I had a good time doing it. I went away to university to study law. And decided I hated it because I went to law because when I was sat in the careers teacher's office and they said to me, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to work in radio and TV. And they said, I haven't got it in the book. There's no internet. I haven't got this big book. Choose something else. And I didn't want anything else. But I was forced by my parents who wanted me to choose something and the teachers because the university was coming along and got your A-level choices. I went, what about law? And they went, yeah, great, do law. And I thought, good, well, you've stopped complaining now, but I had no interest in it. So I was on this conveyor belt to go through law. Went up to sixth form, which was great. I got some decent O-levels. Got reasonably... Well, the problem with sixth form was I became the chairman of the student committee, which means I was the head boy, effectively, for the whole sixth form, about 300 students underneath me. So I was attending all the teachers' events, and I really loved it. I organized all the parties, everything, and I just lost interest in anything to do with school. So when it came around to the exams, I was like, right, I've got to cram it in last minute. In fact, I can say with complete honesty that all the English literature books I had to read, I haven't read to this day. I just read those Let's Revise books instead, crammed what the answers might be if I knew from reading the books, and that's what I answered, and I managed to get enough to go to law school. So I went away to law school, and I did enjoy it. I didn't go to a proper university. I went to an institute that had a big, famous law college next to it, and I really enjoyed it until the second year. And what happens with lawyers is they start off socializing, getting on with everything, that's fine. But then the second year, they get serious. And people who you've been your friends for a whole 12 months suddenly came in wearing suits with briefcases, not talking to anybody and sitting and studying on their own, because that's what you have to do on those days before AI, that's what I had to do. And I found myself not being interested in just doing these long, boring papers on my own. So I just lost interest in it. And after about two and a half years, I dropped out of doing it. Started selling insurance, which I was terrible at, and DJing in one of my local clubs, which I was very good at. And remember at the time, I was probably about 18, 19 years old. So the pressure of life is zero, apart from the fact you feel guilty because I dropped out of law school, and you feel guilty because everyone else seems to have their act better than you. But then I had a conversation with a friend of mine who said, right, he was a DJ at this nightclub as well. He said, you shouldn't be here. He said, you should go off and become an entertainer. I said, what do you mean? He said, go to the holiday resorts in the UK and study to be an entertainer. I went, well, what is that? He said, you'll find out. So he enrolled me at one of the holiday resorts. It was called Warners at the time. And in the UK, they've got these hotels, and they were developed during the 60s when people couldn't really afford to go on holiday abroad. So they made holiday camps that people could go to. They get entertainment, get food, and it was cheap and cheerful. And we go for a week, 2 weeks, done. And they still exist as institutions, but they're great places to learn to be an entertainer. So I didn't want to go because I had friends and girlfriends and stuff like that. But he persuaded me one fine night after I finished DJing. We stayed there for about 4 hours. And he said to me, you have to go. I went, no, I don't want to. I've got stuff here. And he said, and he worked his way through until I went, okay. So I went to the audition reluctantly. He drove me there and I got the job. And I left with immediate effect because I had to start like a couple of days afterwards. And I left all my Essex, all my stuff behind, all my friends, everything. And I went away and became a full-time entertainer. And it was the best experience I ever had because you end up getting a martial art in being able to engage people, especially audiences. You're doing everything from running kids clubs to doing bingo to doing singing on stage and doing shows to doing sports days. But what you learn is when you've got a microphone in your hand and you have an audience around you, you are on. You have to engage them, even if you haven't started yet, even if you're waiting to start at 5 o'clock and there's half an hour to go because you got there early, you entertain, you engage. And it's a really powerful thing that I learned there, because what happened is years later, when I moved to Dubai, that ability to breathe, to live and breathe entertainment made it much easier for me to engage when I do corporate events and hosting Dubai Rugby Sevens for 18 years, going out in front of 50,000 people in an audience for 3 days, just with a microphone and access to a DJ. And we won the best entertainment event in the region for those 18 years. So to go back in time a little bit, I left the holiday resorts and I went away to get a postgraduate diploma in radio journalism. I realized radio journalism kind of filled the gap. It allowed me to have what was equivalent to a degree, but not a degree. I didn't finish my law degree. So I went in, and I went in as an entertainer. Everybody in the room who was studying was a graduate who just suddenly walked out, or maybe a postgraduate. They've walked out with their degree, and they're all very academic. I'd gone from being an entertainer wearing dungarees and a baseball cap and just partying all the time, and everyone thought I was the kid who'd arrived on a bursary. You know, we just helped him up. It wasn't. Yeah. I was paying my way. And I aced it. But I aced it in the way that I do things. As in, when it was a radio journalism course, and they were saying, right, well, you've got to do all this studying, and then you've got to learn to do papers and shorthand. I went, no, it's radio. I just need to record the conversations. I don't need to learn all these other skills. Your qualifications are out of date. To which they begrudgingly said, yes, but still do it anyway. So I did that. Went to work at the BBC, worked for the BBC for about 3-4 years as a freelance. And I wanted a staff job. And I went for probably about 30 staff jobs up and down the country for black people. They realized there was a problem, and they created jobs for people of color. And I never got a single one. Now, bear in mind, I was already working at the BBC as a freelancer. I was running magazines. I was entertaining on stages and doing shows. And I was doing everything. I was working for the Prince's Trust, now King Charles. But Prince Charles at the time had a trust for helping young people, ex-offenders, long-term unemployed, and so on. I was doing everything you would needed to say, let's get this guy in. I was actually overqualified as well. And I didn't get that break. And I got bored of going to these job interviews and not getting it. It's like my face didn't fit with a chart of what kind of color of people they wanted to have for a black person job. So I threw all the eggs in one basket. I went on a TV show called Blind Date. Now, this is before internet. It was in the days of that was the first reality TV show in the UK. So you had Blind Date, which was a dating game show, it was a personality show, and Gladiators, which was a fitness show, on a Saturday before you go out and party. That's what everybody, the whole country would watch. And so I went on Blind Date, and I won the Christmas show, and I had about 20 million people watching, which was fantastic, and I went away to Lapland with a woman who hated me, but that doesn't matter. But it was a great show where the actual footage was fantastic, and when you do a show, especially a reality TV show, and you come out really well, then everybody feels that and everybody congratulates you, and it's really good. My sister was on the same show and she didn't win, not the same episode, and she got a lot of grief from people who just... She was seen by many as a loser, and that really hurt, and it was really unfair. But that's the nature of working on a reality TV show, and the public sees what the marketing wants them to see. And it can either play really well as a hero, or it can play really badly and they bury you. And that's not the real version of you. That's a public version of you. So I went on Blind Date. I won the Blind Date show. I got offers to work on TV shows. I contacted him. In the days, he had a VHS cassette, which no, like a book that you'd put into a machine, and it would just play 1 hour, and then it'd be empty. You got to then put a new one in. So I sent these out to a number of different TV shows and got 4 auditions. MTV was one of them, but there were a number of other big ones in the UK. And all of them turned into Dear Johns, as in, thank you, but no thank you. But you found out 3 months later, because you're waiting for the phone call, or you're waiting for the post to send a letter. It's not like an email or a text message. So you had to wait. And then I realised that I should move down to London, because I was based in the northeast of England. Started going for job interviews in London, and I thought, I don't want to live here. In fact, you know what? I don't want to live in this country. So therefore, my experience at the BBC, which I was hoping they'd turn around after I went on one Blind Date, and they'd say, that's the audition we wanted, this is the next generation of presenters, the opposite happened. I came in, all my colleagues said, great show, and the big boss, who'd clearly been waiting to get rid of me, said, Dave, we're going to let you go. I meant, why? He said, clearly your direction is in a different way from the BBC. I thought, what? I'm doing it as an audition for you. I want to show you how good I am at doing this. So you just say, yes, we want more of you. And it went the other way. So I was disgruntled and pissed off, to be honest. And I just thought, right, that's it, UK, goodbye. And I decided to travel. No idea where I was going to go. And once you decide that it's time to go, nothing seems permanent anymore. And so I got a job offer to DJ in a bar in Dubai, the Marriott Hotel that just opened up in Deira. And they said, if you want this job, you have to go in like 3 or 4 days because we're just opening up for the season and we need you there. And funnily enough, the guy who I took over from is in Dubai tomorrow. I'm meeting him. He's not been here for 30 years. That's a fascinating conversation that's going to be. And so I took the job because I was burning up inside. I couldn't stay and there was nothing, not enough for me. Came over to Dubai, DJed the bar. And there's a fact that nobody will believe or nobody will understand, but it's completely true. I introduced all you can eat and drink to Dubai. To the UAE and probably the Middle East at the same time. With our bar, I brought in a thing called the 100 Club. 100 dirhams, all you can eat and drink on a Thursday, once a month. And it was a mess. You can imagine 100 dirhams. You got everyone walking in wearing their best gear and then the walking dead at the end of it. And in those days, you'd have people, because we didn't have mobile phones in those days because they're the ones that were like suitcases. And people just pass out in the bathrooms. And security at 4 o'clock would hear banging on the door, go down, open it up, and somebody like that. And it was fascinating. But that was the first all you can eat and drink. And so from there, I went into radio. I got an opportunity because they were launching a new radio station, 104.8 Channel 4 FM. They brought over a load of people from the UK. And I was a DJ. I was kind of reluctant because of my BBC experience to want to throw myself in the front line of radio again. So I reluctantly said, yeah, let's have a look at it. And I also realized that if I didn't step up to it, then it would go past me and I wouldn't get to be on the starting team. So I joined, took a weekend show and just was there when radio first opened up in the UAE because we had a really boring station at the time, Dubai 92. And those days was very, I mean, they used to have soundscapes, which was between, I think, 1 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They'd just play classical music every day. And people would just have to not listen to the radio, but they had nobody telling them not to. We came in with a commercial radio and we aced it. So I got to work with big stars, Spice Girls, James Brown, Enrique Iglesias, all the big DJ gigs, all the big entertainment that came in, Bryan Adams, UB40, Sting, all these guys came over. And because I had such experience of being on stage, I was the go-to person to host these events. So I got to work with all these guys, and I got to work with the audiences, and that turned into running Dubai Rugby Sevens Entertainment for 18 years, and also working on a number of other events that happened that were big concerts, which included working with Kanye West and The Prodigy and just a number of big stars, The Wailers, Korn, Slash, all these different artists came over. And for about 10 years, I did these huge events with maybe 15,000, 20,000 people, usually at Dubai Media City, just around here as well. Yeah. And so after a while, and after being on the radio for such a long time, I kind of just grew out of it. I'd had enough of being positioned. I got it out of my system. All the things I wanted to prove in the UK, this is me, this is what I do. I just went, I don't need to. I want to settle down now. I had a beautiful girlfriend who became my wife. Later on, I made a kid, got two dogs. And I just thought, I don't want to be at the forefront of what happens when you put yourself in the celebrity mode. And so I left radio. People said, you're crazy. Why would you leave radio? I just said, it's empty for me. I don't need to do it anymore. And at the time, I was very well known. Everywhere I went, I could get into free events all the time. When you leave radio, by the way, your phone stops ringing and nobody calls you to do anything. I became not persona non grata, but just off the list of people that they wanted to contact. And it was like falling off a cliff. I went from must have Dave Crane to nobody rang me, and they hadn't since. But what I did was I then created my own world at my own pace, the way I wanted it to be, and it's been the best journey. That's included running all kinds of events and also becoming a motivational speaker, traveling around the world, training the Olympics team in Abu Dhabi to run the Olympics in Abu Dhabi. You know, I ran the team, the MC team, and I've worked on so many different events, sporting events, travel around the world. It's been an incredible thing. But one of the best decisions I made was to leave radio, because when you work for a big organization, you're not the first choice of everything. It's politically driven by, that's our breakfast show presenter, we must put him first. When you are independent and you run it yourself, then you're there because of your own weight and your own way of doing it. And I think it's fascinating now that the world is in that direction. Right now, you create a personal brand that proves who you are and what you can do. You know your market, and you've got actual proof of the quality of what you deliver, and you deliver that whenever you're brought in, and you gather evidence to prove that. You don't need a big organization. That's why being a freelancer, or at least running a small organization, outsourcing what you need to have and building your brand, I think is essential right now. But I also think it's never been easier to become a pseudo celebrity. I said that's a wrong phrase, not a pseudo celebrity, to be a thought leader and be an industry icon. Because don't do it because you're good looking. Don't do it because you're connected. Do it because you know your stuff really well and you can share that with others. And the fact you are brilliant at what you do will elevate you, if you publicize it right, to people who want to work with you. So that's kind of my journey.
Interesting story, man.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's more, but I thought that was a potted version that would work really well.
And I actually like that. Maybe we should build on that to actually, I don't know, but that's what I'm thinking as well about for the podcast. Like it's very personal as well. The podcast is very personal. Especially when you ask the question, like if I didn't ask you this question, who is Dave? And then we started with, because I've researched you, I know what I'm going to ask you. You have a lot of experience in public speaking, a lot of experience in, so NLP I'm interested in, right? A lot of experience in so many things and different experiences, right? A lot of verticals that I want to tap into.
Do you know I'm a stage hypnotist as well? Did I tell you that?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so the NLP I've taken to the sharpest possible level of like a rock concert. Can you get people to do stuff live in front of a room full of skeptics?
I saw it. And you listed it there on your LinkedIn profile as well. What did you say? Like a hypnotherapist, right? You say it here, like a master hypnotherapist. So here you go. So there are so many things to talk about. And if I didn't ask you who is Dave, then we would have skipped that intro.
Completely.
And it's a great context to know who you are before you start answering all these questions that I have for you.
Let me add one thing to that before we do it. I know we're going to be talking about storytelling. There's a very important part of it, and I just want to cap it so then the rest of it makes more sense. Yeah. Whenever you do storytelling, whenever you're looking at your favorite TV show, the only reason that show works and gets you interested in it is when you understand the core wound of the main character. So every single character, whether it's the superhero character, Luke Skywalker, what drives Luke Skywalker? He lost his parents at an early age, so therefore the Force and Ben Kenobi filled that gap. Superman lost his parents at an early age. Take The Sopranos, Tony Soprano, who's, you know, not the nicest of people. What drives him? What's his core wound? His mother bullied him and treated him really badly when he was a kid. So it's important when you do engage with people to be honest about your core wound, because then they see everything that you've done as a reply to whether that core wound is fixed or it's made it worse. And that's how TV runs it, and that's how storytelling runs it. So for me, I didn't realize this until I did a lot of soul searching through the pandemic and afterwards, that my entire journey, and the reason I was happy to stop being an entertainer and stop being a celebrity maybe 10, 15 years ago, was that core wound of being a little black kid trying to tell everybody, I am as good as everybody else. Please pay attention. Once I'd done that, I could go, see, there you go. And I realized I wasn't showing anybody, it was me. I was just proving to me, and that's why I was happy to walk away quietly and let the curtain come down and the credits roll. So my key phrase is jump and grow wings on the way down. That's what I show people how to do. When I do my industry icon and everything else and the questions we're going to have, I show people how to jump and grow wings on the way down, because most people won't do that. But when you do it and you're good enough, you'll find your way.
Do it. Awesome, man. Who is Dave Crane?
I have no idea. On a daily basis, he changes.
Love it, man. Finally, we meet, man.
I'm pleased. Yeah. And you asked one question, and I realize it's opening up a whole load of stuff before we look at anything else. But most people don't know, not about me, forget me. And it's not important who I am. The only thing that's important about me is what people can get out of me.
Of course.
That helps them better.
100%.
But most people don't ask themselves what they're offering to the world. They just do what they do and wonder why it's working or not working. That's why the branding is so important. So you show the world what you can do to help them, and the right people will align with your message and buy from you and work with you. But if you don't have the guts to put it front and center, then you'll never find out.
Right. So what is the one thing you do for a living? I know that you help people become better, grow, etc. Well, what is it? How do you phrase it? What's that elevator pitch, if you wanna?
My elevator pitch is I help decision makers go from unknown and invisible to be able to have a very strong, powerful personal brand, to be able to speak and market themselves so they instantly can turn it into sales, and also they become seen as an industry icon.
Do you think personal branding and celebrity status are overrated in a world where everyone declares themselves to be an influencer?
I think that when you see the amount of world leaders at the top of a government in a country that are only there because they drove their celebrity status and they played the branding card, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, look at a lot of these politicians who've made it there, it's a beauty pageant. And politics has always been like that, but for many days and for many years, it was all about the ability to go through the system. These guys are hijacking the system. They're driving it through social media, and there's a lot of money to drive these ads, and there's a lot more algorithms that go into the marketing that are very smart and very clever, not least the fact that if you want to get people to make things go viral, they've got to be funny, or they've got to make you angry. If they make you go, I feel like a better person, they don't go viral. So that's why it's been so much of a push and so much a reception for the politics that we've got right now, because it's, if you get angry with it, then there's a conversation to be had. And the minute a conversation is had for that weird guy who's really angry over there, he becomes a celebrity with the nature of social media. People pass this on to other people. Have you seen this? And the likes of, say, Andrew Tate, who's a celebrity, who is complete antithesis of what I believe in about people, about women, about everything. The reason he's become so big is because there's a conversation about him. Because it's a shocker. But that's the nature of what we have. So there are lots of people who are at the top of the food chain purely because they know how to play that particular game. If we look at possibly the most influential person, if you were to have a president of the world right now, he's probably Elon Musk. Everything he says is dissected by everybody. And some people say he's 100% right. Some people say, I don't like him. But because he is a very, very smart, he's like Tony Stark. He's like the Tony Stark of our time. Clearly an amazing inventor, clearly an amazing thought leader. But when everything gets amplified, so everything he says and does is paid attention to, there's massive scary gaps in there. And that's a lot of the danger of positioning yourself out of your reach. For instance, Madonna, for me, was the biggest pop star I've ever had in a lifetime. But when you look at Madonna and the things she said, sometimes you go, oh, that's a bit cringy, but you can't argue with her business model. She spent four decades as the best artist of all time working with new producers and saying, you've got a new idea, that's really good, let's do an album together. Of course, the producer says, yes, I'm working with Madonna. And then Madonna launches a brand new genre of music, whether it's voguing or whatever it is, and the world says, look at Madonna, she's got some new stuff. Now, I'm not saying she's not a great artist, she is, but she's a very smart marketer, and most people never recognize that. So when I say I create industry icons, there are a set number of rules to go from hero to zero. I can take somebody who's got a reasonable business, who's reasonably well known, and help them become the best in their niche, because when you make it the right noise to the right people with consistency and with your artistry, you also have to be an artist in what you do. So if you're a plumber, it's one thing to go and fix people's sinks. Who cares? But if you do really cool videos and show people, this is how you fix a sink. Can you see? Let's interview the lady. Oh, she's run away. No worries. Let's have a look. And you create this, they become viral. And then even if people can't get you to fix their sink, they want your advice. Who would you recommend? Or what? And suddenly you've got a plumber who fixes sinks. It becomes a world-known phenomenon. That's the key to social media right now, and that's the key to going up the food chain and influence. And if you do it right, you can own your industry. If you do it right, you can own, I won't say any industry, but you can certainly have an impact on other industries as well.
100%.
That's what I show people to do.
Tell me more.
What do you want to know?
How? So let's say you work with me. What do we do? What's the plan?
Well, first of all, we've got to work out who you really are, as in who you really are, because you can't see it sometimes, because it's like a fish looking for water, swimming around saying, where's all this water that people are talking about? Well, you're in it. That's too obvious. So you sometimes need to have somebody on the outside looking in to see what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and then the things that you could amplify that really do resonate with people. Then we work out who your target audience is, who it is that you want to reach. And when I hear 99% of people, and talk to people about their audience, who is it that you, who's your target audience? Anybody who, the minute they say anybody, they're wrong. Not anybody, it's specific. Because if you get it too thin, it's nobody. But if you say, I target blah, 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 and you tell me the criteria, then we know who it is you're aiming for. And it might be you've got different avatars. It might be you reach them, but you reach them and you reach them. But the lowest hanging fruit is the best one to go for, because it's easiest to convert. So then you've got one person who then starts to find out who they are. Then you've got an audience that will pay for their stuff. And then you've got to find a message of what do they offer that this audience really wants. And what message do they need to be able to understand it? Once you marry the two together, then they go online, they share all the stuff about their core message. And everything they post gets people to say, that's the person I want. Now that person who says, I'm going to spend with them, has to see it in a number of different places. You have to see about 8 or 9 places, and they have to see it a number of different times. And they've got to be able to watch videos and read books and spend about 7 or 8 hours with their content before they say, that's the one I want. I've got to find them in different places. So if all you do is LinkedIn and nothing else, then that's not enough. They need to be able to find you in different places. Then they will buy from you. So the challenge for many people is they don't like the idea of holding. When I was at the BBC, my job was to interview people. My job was to basically hold up a mirror to them. And if they answered well or they answered badly, I was representing as a mirror the audience watching. So if they don't answer properly, I say, well, I don't think that's true. Could you elaborate on it a bit more? But if they decide to carry on lying, the audience will see the lies. And that's, I keep banging this microphone because it's so close to my face. Mm. And that's ultimately what it is that you do. And so many people don't want to look inside themselves because they're really worried what we're going to find. And so that's the first step, realizing who you are and celebrating. I'm a short, fat bloke. with dreadlocks. Well, Platts, actually, who's in my 50s, and I've lived in Dubai for 30 years. I've got a beautiful family. And will I ever look like Ryan Reynolds? No. Will I ever, I probably look like Morgan Freeman's little brother, if anything, but I'm happy in that space. I'm not going to win any beauty pageants, but on the thing I do really well, there's very few people who can match me on it. I believe everybody's got that superpower. We just have to work out what it is and amplify it.
Right. And you work then with people on public speaking. So part of how you help people become these icons, the industry icons, is through as well public speaking, NLP,
or not necessarily? It's a combination of things. Okay. I used to, when I first studied to be a life coach, I hated the phrase life coach. Because everywhere you went, there's a life coach. And then it all got really sort of like bitchy. Who did you study with? Who did you study NLP with? And then it became which school, which guru. And I hated that because at the end of the day, it's only about the good you can do to help people. That's your bottom line, not where you come from. That's no guarantee to anything. So I reinvented myself as a life designer. That's a phrase I used, as a life designer, because I spent about 10 years as a healer and motivational speaker and trainer and so on. And when people said, who did you study with? I said, I went to the University of TJ. They go, ooh, that's interesting. TJ was the name of my dog. I just put it in there to stop people making complaints about where they'd been and all the rest of it. So the idea was very much about creating an impact that helps other people. And so the labels aren't so important all the time, because as soon as you put a label out there, people turn around and say, right, okay, that's it. We're going to do that. And I spent a lot of time being a life coach. Life coaches are probably the lifeblood of the planet, but the problem is they're really bad at marketing themselves. They're brilliant doing their job, and nobody wants to pay for happiness. We kind of do now after the pandemic, but people still go shopping and buy shoes and buy clothes and buy a beer rather than spending time learning on how they could be much happier.
100%.
I didn't answer your question though, did I?
Yeah, you did somehow. I'm going to build on it.
Okay.
You like to tell stories, man.
I don't.
You do.
But I realize I have to.
Maybe because you're trained. And that's one of the questions, like, why storytelling? Like, how important is storytelling? Because you tell stories, and I've seen your content on Instagram and on LinkedIn, you tell stories. And I know that storytelling is very important in public speaking, right? So what is it? How important is storytelling?
Yeah, I'm a reluctant storyteller because I'm massively private. I'm a massive introvert. And so during a pandemic, I actually enjoyed the doors closing and choosing when I wanted to go online and not having to go to places and meet people. Because even though I'm the excellence of working audiences, it's like a battery. It takes everything out of you. So then you have to recuperate by hiding. And any entertainer that you talk to at the highest level will say there's a yin and yang to them. They like to be super private, but also when they're in public, that's what they do. So, sorry, the question again was...
How important is storytelling? Specifically for business leaders or for managers or for people to become these industry icons.
There's a bottom line of storytelling. Nobody cares who you are. Nobody cares what you've done, but they might want to do business with you. If you tell people facts and figures, they will zone out because it's a lot to take in. But if you tell them a story about who you've affected and how you've helped them, it plays on a different part of your mind. It lights up 7 different parts of your brain under a CAT scan, as opposed to 1 or 2 parts of your brain. When you tell a story about the little lady who came to you and just launched a sandwich business, and she wasn't able to reach people, but she really wanted to get her new recipe out to people. So you sat with her and you worked with her, and she didn't have a lot of money, but she had this really good recipe. So after a while you said, well, why don't we just create some social media? Why don't you go live while you're making your sandwiches and tell people about how your mum taught you how to do it? So she starts doing this, and suddenly people are saying, that's interesting, and recognizing her. And when she said, if you'd like to have this, we're available in this store. And she was taking the sandwiches in at the beginning of the day, and they sold out, and people started to watch her show. And from that, she was able to scale. She got a team in who were making the sandwiches, and they were delivering to offices, delivering to shops, and she was able to take it to a whole new brand. As a direct result, her business went from 0 or a handful of customers to being a million a year business, purely because of the amplification and the fact she was genuine, and the love that went in with the sandwiches is what people felt, because it reminded them when they were growing up and their mother would make their sandwiches. Now, I've just made up that story, But if I was to tell you about how my marketing took people from zero to a million, then you'd go, oh, that's fascinating, but thank you. But if I was to tell you about Mrs. Miggins and her pie shop and sandwich shop, then suddenly you've got an identity. And that's what we were brought up to remember from a very young age. We learned fairy tales that we can still recall now. 30 years after we last heard them, I can recall and tell you any of the fairy tales I was told as a child because they took me emotionally on a journey. That's why storytelling is a martial art that most business people don't understand. When you can amplify stories, true stories, about your business, then people will buy into you and the way it made them feel, and they can spread that word to other people. So there's a key to this for every single business person who wants to be able to unleash their stories. Go through your catalogue of products. Go through the results you've had. Write out a question for every single thing that anybody could ask you. That's a brutal question. Why did you do that? How did you do that? How do you manage to affect it? What do you do under those circumstances? And write a story that justifies why you do it. You may have 60 stories. You might have 100 stories. Write them all down and categorize them as an answer to each of these different problems. And when you go out, select the story in sales meetings, in interviews, in chats, about how you made a difference through your business and made one person or one company's life better. And people want to hear you. And that will amplify. Not only will people talk about you and word of mouth will be incredible, but also you'll find yourself on stages telling your stories. And people will just say, that's a person I want to work with.
I love it. And that is one way to develop telling stories. Like you said, write them down. How else do you develop the skills of telling stories?
Well, you have to think ultimately about what it is that people want. Mm. Your audience should always feel that this applies to them. So, for instance, if you tell a story about a guy who's a millionaire who's given money by his dad and then became a billionaire, whoopee-doo. Who cares about that story? But if you were to tell a story about a person who went from zero to being a millionaire, that intrigues, not just because most people are in that position, but also because the fact is you want to know how they dealt with having zero and the mindset and the drive and what they went through and the challenges, and that makes a really good, interesting story. Reason stories are so effective is 99% of Hollywood movies are based on one story, the hero's journey. The hero's journey has a guy or a girl who's a bit of a fish out of water. They're very good at doing one thing, but they're also a bit of a nerd or a geek at the same time. And they do all right, but people don't take them seriously sometimes. But then a big challenge comes along. It could be scoring a goal in the cup final. It could be taking the girl of their dreams to prom. It could be an alien invasion. It could be that they've got a disability, but they have to deal with it. It could be a ton of different things. But then they attempt to do it and they fail badly. At that stage, the mentor comes along. The mentor, who's a Morgan Freeman, Kevin Costner, Yoda, Obi-Wan Kenobi type character, comes along and says, I've done this before. Let me show you how to do it. Of course, the star, the hero, goes, no, I don't want to do it. I'll do it on my own. I'm fine. And reluctantly they get persuaded to join the mentor. Then the mentor takes them on a journey away from their world into a brand new world where their expertise means zero. And they fall over a lot and they make a fool of themselves, but it's a learning curve. And all the way you can see them growing and paying attention until they get to a point where they just go, actually, I'm not so bad at this. And then the original problem comes back again. Taking the girl to prom, it's that night. Football, scoring that penalty, you now have a penalty in last minute. The aliens are outside your house and they've got to step up. And just at that point where they've got to step up and go into battle and they start battling, a tragedy hits them. A loved one dies, something terrible that makes them fall down and never be able to get back up again. But then they dig deep into themselves and they resurrect their fallen spirit, their broken body, their challenge, and they raise themselves up beyond where they would be and they win. They get the girl, they score the goal, they repel the alien invasion against all odds. And then they're left with a situation where, do I then go back to where I was before? As a hero, or do I just take this new thing that I've learned about and spread the word of that, or do I ride off into the sunset to find new adventures? Now, as I say this, there's a number of people turn around and say, oh, yeah, I know that story. That was a story of 99% of Hollywood movies. That's why they tell that story. But the thing that most people don't know is most people spend their life wanting to be the hero, the star. How do I get this to happen? But the smart people, as you're doing with this podcast, realize that it's not about you. It's what about the difference you can make to people. So you don't become the hero. You become the mentor. So your experiences is about helping them on their journey. Your clients are the hero. You are the Kevin Costner, the Morgan Freeman, who helps them get what they need. And that's the key to storytelling.
Man. I love it. Wow, too powerful, man. It's all coming together.
You keep asking the questions, I'll keep giving you answers.
Man. Okay. Oh, we're still here. We're still in the podcast. Oh, man, you took me on a journey. Love it. I've got to be careful how I ask you questions, man.
Well, every answer that I give you is roughly about 20 minutes long.
Bro, book us the day. Love it. Okay. You're big on personal branding. Although you said you're an introvert, but you're still big because you see the benefits and you coach people on it. How to grow a personal brand from your experience? Maybe not your personal experience, but how to grow a personal brand from the people that you've worked with, and where do you start? Where to start? Because it took me 2 years to put my first video live, right? And it took me probably 5-6 years of thinking about a podcast before starting it.
And now?
And now I wish I started 5 years ago, and I wish I put my video 2 years before. But I did it.
What's my signature phrase?
Yours?
Jump and grow wings.
And grow wings.
On the way down.
Right. And that's, I made a video. I don't know if I put it live already. I did already. That nobody cares about you. Really. Like, how many people love to see you succeed? How many?
Nobody cares.
One, two, maybe your dad, maybe your
parents.
Mom. Maybe.
Right? Maybe.
And how many people really then care about you? Nobody. So why do you care about how? And you said it in your story. Like, you are this black kid.
I'm actually mixed race, but black right. is easier to see.
But you know what I mean. Like, yeah, but in the story, like, I'm this black kid.
Yep.
And at the end, I wanted to prove myself that I'm a hero and I could do it. But nobody really cared about you.
No. Nope.
Everybody's in their own journey.
I still don't.
So here you go. And I don't. And you're right. When we were kids, we don't know any better. We're worried. And like, it's all about others. And that's what I always tell people. Like, get started. And it's difficult to get started. Go to the gym. Do the first step. Just go to the gym for the first time. You're going to love it. Right? So how to grow a personal brand and where to start?
Right. Well, everybody is a brand, whether they know it or not. So anybody who's ever created a social media profile.
But sorry, I want to go back to that. Why did you say I'm not a? Why did you, when I told you you're a black kid, and then we're gonna go back to this. Why did you say I'm actually mixed?
Because I had no choice but to say I'm black, and my dad's white, and my mom's black, and so I didn't really fit into both, to either. I actually went on a pilgrimage to the West Indies to where my mom's from. I met all the family. And the family were lovely, but the society hated me. And I found that I'm not a West Indian. There's no promised land of people waiting to give me coconuts and say, Dave, come and join the gang. I'm a black Brit. And the reason I bring it up is because I moved to Dubai because Britain wasn't the right place for me either. I found it really difficult at the back end of Thatcher's Britain, where racism, and I feel that there's a lot that, not as bad as it was when I left, but there's a real racist world out there being amplified by social media. Most people aren't. Most people are lovely. But the social media makes things that make you angry flag up. Yeah. And so for me, I had to double down. I didn't realize. I mean, I came to Dubai because color didn't matter. Dubai has got, what, best part of almost 200 nationalities, all living in relatively perfect harmony, because business drives everything. If you can't do business, you can't make money, you can't be here. But people all move together to meet a friend, and you meet their wife, and it's a completely different nationality. You don't even blink an eyelid, just go, oh, that's fascinating. But that's Dubai.
Why did you say I'm not black, I'm mixed?
I just threw it into the conversation because I found that when Black Lives Matters happened, I did a video all about the importance of understanding diversity and helping people. And when my friends in America showed it to black Americans, they said, oh, he's not American, what does he know? And I found it, I thought, what? So I'm being rejected by my own people? I thought we're all in it together, and we're not. I'm in it my way, but it doesn't mean I can't help people. So when I said it, it wasn't to defend me for me. I know who I am, but I wanted it to be that anybody who feels that they're a different person, not black, not white, but mixed, can also buy into my story and position themselves as who they are. Because there are a lot of lonely people out there, and very few people get shown the ground rules of how to keep yourself afloat. Right now, the biggest suicide rate is us, 45-year-old men who can't move forward. There's no answer, and all you feel is the only way out is just to go. We're the ones holding up a family. We are this table, and our families are on top of it, and nobody tells us how to be here, and that's why the suicide rate is so big. So it's important to flag up and tell people they're not alone. And they can do it. And that's why it was important for me to say, I am mixed. So anybody who's watching who is mixed knows I'm there for them as well.
Makes sense. Clear. How to grow a personal brand? Answer that. A way to start.
So who is asking that question?
I am.
Is it about your brand? Is it about somebody else's brand? Because it's different for everybody. Everybody's journey is different, and everybody's audience is different. And some people, it's very easy. You just flip. One of my clients came to me, and is a successful guy who's created and built most of many of the big iconic buildings in Dubai. He's a British guy, been a director for some of the bigger companies, places like Burj Khalifa and so on. He built them. And he came to me and said, Dave, I watched up the rugby for like the last 10 years, going out in the middle of a pitch with a microphone and entertaining people. And I'll see you on LinkedIn talking about how to grow brands. He said, can I come and work with you? I said, yes. So he came and joined me on the Industry Icon program, and we worked through who he was, what he did, and how to move forward. Now, he is mentoring hundreds of people around the world. He's launched his own academy. He's got his own book coming out soon. And he gets offered seven-figure contracts every week because he's now put his own brand out there. And his back catalogue of successes speak for themselves. He's not got a massive following, but he's got a following of the people who want to work with him. And that's the thing about vanity metrics. And you know, you work in marketing. It's not about how many people go, we love you. And then they find out what you do for a living. And we go, oh, okay, well, we still love you. But keep putting those cat videos on because we love them. Yeah. But when you talk about yourself, not interested. It's about finding out who you are, what you do, and how you can help people. And you can't help everybody, but you want to help the people that are open to it. I mean, it's like, for instance, I was talking to somebody yesterday, and she was saying, right, can you work with me? And she kept telling me how great she was. And I went, well, I think I've got a problem working with you. And she said, well, why? I said, I don't think you can be coachable. All you've done is gone about yourself, which means if I tell you something that's going to burst your bubble, you're going to resist. And then you're not going to get the results, and you're going to blame me. I'm really good at what I do. But you also have to be open to being shown that sometimes the weakest part of you can become the strongest part of you. And that's what will resonate with people. The whole world is full of everybody. I mean, status is driven by three things. Your status, and status is universal. For thousands of years, status is the number one thing that puts you at the top of everyone's food chain. That's about your dominance in your industry. It's about your expertise and as being a professional. And it's about your virtue in the fact that you're able to say, I do this in and out, and this is what I do. I thought you were just saying stop talking then, but you're scratching your hand. But here's the thing. So when you look at your dominance, that's your Lionel Messi's and your Ronaldo's. Dominance of your industry, fantastic at what they do. Then you've got your expertise, that's your Elon Musk's. the guys who are able to show I'm the richest man on the planet, or the second richest now, but he goes up and down. If he buys any more social media, he'll go down a little bit further.
Yeah.
So that's his expertise. Clearly the money says he's there. Then you've got virtue. You've got people like the Pope or Michelle Obama who are able to turn around and say, I live by my bond. I won't do stuff unless I really honestly do believe it's the right thing to do. Now, for most people, they're never going to be at that top of the food chain, and they don't have to be, but you can show the same thing by being truthful, by being warm, and by helping people when you are better than people, show them the right way to move forward. That ticks all the status boxes, and you can amplify that by giving the right tips for people. Tell them as a story, and they're able to digest it, and it sticks in their head, and they're able to tell other people how to do it. So branding has a number of different elements to go to, which are partly about getting to see what your status is so other people can get there, but also it's a journey for yourself. A journey of self-discovery when you do it right. Mm. Because I've got a group right now that I'm working with about 150 people in one of my communities, and I ask them a question to grade themselves out of 100% as to how big their brand is. And I broke it down into 20%, 20%. It's five different questions. And the amount of people turned around and they had 75 to 90%. This is me. I'm a great brand. You know, I'm doing really well. And I'm thinking, halve it first and then have another look at it. Because if you are that good, why are you in my group? If you're at that level, you don't need me to help you. But you're delusional. And you're also looking at the fact that if you want to be positioned, it's not about how happy you are for you. That's very important. But it's about how you affect other people. Would other people see you as a 95%? If the answer is no, then don't. So it's very personal, but you get your person and then you amplify it to the world to see what they want to react to. And your journey is not about being the best that you can be. It's not about being the best in the world. It's about being all you can be. And part of that is about your personal brand and your business. But part of it is about being a father. It's about being a friend. It's about being a dog parent. It's about being somebody who gives back to the community and helps the people who need it most to be able to get to where they need to be. That's all you can be. We're driven by capitalism to say only if you have the money are you at the top of the food chain. And we're sat here in a dress shirt, nice T-shirt. We're not here in three-piece suits showing you my Hugo Boss suit to prove that I'm, you know, always dressing like that. And the pandemic taught me a lot. Because when you're on your own in your house and you've got nobody else that you can talk to, it really tells you what really matters in life. And I could go on about that particular area, I won't, but I think that your brand is a number of different things. You've got to work out who you are, who your audience are, and find the best way to communicate that message to them in a way that they want to take it.
Makes sense. We ran out of time.
No, we've hardly answered any questions.
I know. I told you. We have to do another one. I still have a lot of questions, man. We still didn't cover half of them.
Ask me a big one.
The big one?
Anyone.
One thing to leave the audience, the listeners with.
The one thing I would say to everybody is the one thing that that people who work with dying people say. Everyone thinks that they had more time. You don't. I got a phone call in the middle of the night whilst I was hosting the World Cup cricket. ICC World Cup cricket. And there's a phone call at 4:30 and I picked it up and I was like, who's this? And they said, it's a hospital in Leeds in the UK. And okay, said your dad's got COVID. He's not going to make it. Ring your family and tell them to come in. So I rang everybody in the UK. It was 1:30 in the morning. And luckily somebody could get their phone and put Zoom on. I said goodbye to my dad at an hour as all the family started arriving. And then he was gone. Do I miss him all the time? I talk to my mum every single day, every day without fail on Zoom. So all the things about, you know, how do I look and do they love me today and all the rest of that, that's BS. You have a certain amount of time to be all you can be. And the major thing is being happy. And when you get to a certain stage, is making sure that your kids also know how to be happy. You don't have to make them happy. You can't. But you can show them the rules and they can find their own way. And if you can use that and amplify it and help as many people as possible, that's why you are here. That's your legacy. What happens after you're gone?
Amen. thank you.
My pleasure.
It's yeah,
pleasure
beautiful words, man. Yeah, awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll do it again.
I can't wait. We'll go for the rest of your questions.
I'm going to keep them.